I want to welcome you back to another edition of The Gathering Storm. In our prior CD together, we began to take a look at the gay agenda. And I tried to show you what the gay agenda is doing in terms of reinterpreting the Bible to accommodate the gay lifestyle. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how hard you try to rewrite the Bible is eternally settled on this subject. God may love the homosexual, but he is very much against the homosexual lifestyle. That is the plain teaching of the Word of God from Genesis to Revelation, and no amount of gymnastics or linguistic gimmicks can change that. Now, we're continuing our look at the gay agenda in this session, and what we are focused on here is the not so much the biblical side of the biblical angle, but rather the political and the legal side of it. Our country is being placed under tremendous political and legal pressure to adopt and embrace the gay lifestyle, and I want to sort of explain that to us today in this CD. And I want to sort of conclude with some action steps in terms of what we can do to kind of buck the trend, as God in His grace allows it. But one of the things we need to understand about the gay lifestyle is there is a concerted effort, as we look at the political and the legal agenda behind the gay agenda, there is a concerted effort for the gay agenda and gay rights advocates to promote themselves as victims. Let me quote to you from an article entitled Strategies of the Homosexual Movement, The Overhauling of Straight America. This particular writer says this: the following article, entitled The Overhauling of Straight America, was written by Marshall K. Kirk and Erastus Phil, and it appeared in Guide magazine, a homosexual publication, in November of 1997. This landmark article has become the Bible of the homosexual movement and has since been widely republished on the internet and elsewhere. It outlines the strategies and techniques for a successful widespread propaganda campaign to confuse and deceive the American people and demonize opponents. Like all propaganda, their methods are based not on solid intellectual arguments, but instead upon emotional manipulation of the public in an attempt to gain widespread sympathy and approval for homosexual behavior. As you read this, keep in mind that it was written in 1987, well over two decades ago, and look around and see how far the homosexual movement has gotten using these techniques. And the very first technique described in this article is portray gays as victims, not as aggressors or challengers. So let me quote from this article entitled Overhauling Straight America, which is sort of a playbook, if you will, for the homosexual lobby. Quote, in any campaign to win over the public, gays must be cast as victims in need of protection so that straights will be inclined by reflex to assume the role of protector. If gays are presented instead as strong and prideful, as a strong and prideful tribe promoting a rigidly nonconformist and deviant lifestyle, they are more likely to be seen as a public menace that justifies resistance and oppression. For this reason, we must forego the temptation to strut our gay pride publicly when it conflicts with the gay victim image. And we must walk the fine line between impressing straits with our great numbers on the one hand and sparking their hostile paranoia, they are all around us, on the other. So, you know, you can see right from the get-go that what this movement wants to do is portray itself as a victim. And so when we talk about the legal and political agenda behind the gay rights movement, we have to understand that one of their goals is to, what I like to call, piggyback upon the civil rights movement. In the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we granted to racial minorities legal protections. And what the gay rights movement seeks to do is it seeks to portray themselves as a minority group entitled to the same protections afforded to, let's say, African Americans in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, when we as a society made a decision in 1964 that we were going to give racial minorities, whether they're Hispanic, Asian, black, etc., civil rights protection, we said we would do so if certain criteria are satisfied. In order to qualify for special rights, deserving of special rights protection, four criteria must have been met. Number one, the group that needs protection must be sizable. In other words, it must represent a substantial demographic within American society. Number two, that group must be characterized by some kind of immutable characteristic. Immutable means a characteristic about oneself, such as one's skin color or race, that cannot be changed. Number three, the group characterized by this immutable characteristic must be what we call innocuous, in other words, harmless. So when you look at someone who is a racial minority, their skin color is immutable, and obviously they're involved with a group that is harmless on its surface. In other words, being Asian or being black or being Hispanic or being Caucasian or whatever the case may be is not harmful to anyone in and of itself. And then finally, number four, the group had to demonstrate that they had been historically targeted for discrimination. So the group had to show statistically that we have been targeted, we have been deprived economically, we have been deprived of employment, and those kinds of things because of this immutable characteristic. So sizability, immutability, innocuousness, and you also had to show that you had been in the past historically targeted for discriminatory behavior and practices. Now, you take a look at, let's say, African Americans, and you can very easily see how they fit quite easily all four criteria. You know, do they have an immutable characteristic about themselves, something that they cannot change? Yes, obviously. Their skin color, and anyone's skin color, is something that is part of them. They're born that way. We're all born with the skin color we have, and that is an immutable, unchangeable, changeless characteristic. You don't know of people necessarily that used to be Asian or used to be Hispanic or used to be black or used to be Caucasian, because this is a part of us that cannot be changed. It's immutable. And then you look at this other piece of criteria. You have to demonstrate that because of that immutable characteristic, you've been targeted for discrimination. Now, African Americans can easily demonstrate that. All we have to do is go back to the pre-Civil War America, and we can see very clearly that slavery was a reality at one time in this country, sadly. And blacks in America were targeted. They were enslaved. They were discriminated against also in the Jim Crow South expressly because of their skin color. So they were made slaves because of skin color. They were denied jobs and employment because of skin color. They were forced to sit at segregated lunch counters or ride in the back of the bus or drink at a public drinking fountain that's segregated from the rest of society expressly because of skin color. And we also can show very easily that African Americans or blacks are a sizable, large part of the American population. And we can also show that being black is an innocuous characteristic. In other words, being black or being white doesn't make you inherently good or evil just because of that characteristic. The skin color itself in that sense is innocuous. So because blacks or African Americans fit easily into these criteria, they are well deserving of civil rights status or elevated status or civil rights protection under the law. Now, I stand about 6'6", and sometimes I feel discriminated against because I have to duck as I go through doors, and I have to kind of sit in tight quarters on airplanes. And so would being 6'6", would that qualify for civil rights status? Well, there might be a sizable population of us tall people. We certainly are innocuous. In other words, being tall doesn't make one good or bad in that sense. And we all certainly have an immutable characteristic. We're born tall. And I like being tall, but if I didn't like being tall, or if I like being tall, I'm still stuck in this body, so that cannot change. But you see, I wouldn't qualify for civil rights protection. Why is that? Because of this criteria here where I have to demonstrate a historical pattern of discrimination against me. I mean, there is no pattern that I can show economically that, you know, I have been targeted, I've been denied jobs, I've been enslaved, I've been forced to sit at segregated lunch counters because of my height. So you can see why some groups qualify for civil rights protection and some groups don't. And so once you move under civil rights protection, you're shielded by the law from discriminatory practices on the basis of your immutable characteristic. In other words, if you can demonstrate that you are discriminated against in a business or even by government because of this immutable characteristic, under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you're given the opportunity to bring a lawsuit to gain damages and so forth. And so that's just a little bit of background, if you will, on the civil rights movement in the United States of America. Now, having said all that, let me explain to you what is happening. The gay rights movement wants desperately to receive elevated civil rights status and protection. They want to be thought of, if you will, as a black person, as an Asian, or as a Hispanic, and they want to not be discriminated against in any sense, just like we would not discriminate against a racial minority. And if a racial minority is discriminated against, they can bring a suit under civil rights law, and that's what the gay rights movement desperately wants. But let's look at this critically. Do homosexuals fit those four pieces of criteria that I mentioned earlier that allow an individual to qualify for civil rights protection? Well, let's go through these one by one. Number one, do homosexuals represent a numerous or sizable demographic in American society? Now, their argument is they do. One of the things they like to articulate, or they like to say, the gay rights movement likes to say, is that, look, we represent 10% of the population. Now, where does that number, 10% of the population, come from? It comes from a study done by, I believe his first name was Alfred Kinsey. And everybody that quotes 10% of the population is gay looks back or points back to the Kinsey study. The problem is the Kinsey study has been discredited. When Kinsey did his research, he used a sample set that was disproportionate, if you will, relative to the population of the United States of America. So his sample set consisted of prison inmates and gay room bars and places of that nature that would have a disproportionately large amount of homosexuals. So he didn't go into middle America. He went into these bars, these gay bars, prison inmates, and these kinds of places. And from that disproportionate sample set, he determined that 10% of the population is gay. So most everybody that knows what they're talking about would acknowledge that the Kinsey study is something that has been widely discredited and is no longer accepted as bona fide research. In fact, Greg Jackson, in his book, Conservative Comebacks to Liberal Lies, says this: the 10% homosexual statistic comes from the 40-year-old Kinsey report, which has been discredited by just about every study done in this area. Recent studies from the University of Chicago show that 2.8% of males in the United States are homosexuals, and 1.4% of women are lesbians. The maximum percent of the population from any peer-reviewed study ever done is 5%, and many scholars think that this number is on the high side. So the fact of the matter is homosexuals don't even fit this first of these four criteria, that homosexuals represent a numerous and sizable demographic in the United States of America. You'll hear this all the time, that 10% of the American population is gay, and that is not true. The number is probably somewhere a little over 2%, and perhaps even less than 2%, 1%, maybe as low as 1.5%. Well, let's look at the second of these four criteria. Do homosexuals like blacks, like Asians, like Hispanics, like Caucasians, do they possess an immutable characteristic? In other words, is being gay something that you are born with, something that cannot be controlled? The answer, I believe, to that question is no. And let me read to you a couple sentences here. According to Robert L. Spitzer, the renowned gay activist psychiatrist who in 1973 successfully managed to have homosexuality removed from the American Psychiatric Association's list of mental disorders, has published results of his new study, which shows homosexual orientation can be changed to heterosexual orientation. According to Dr. Spitzer's findings, which were eventually published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior, 200 homosexuals changed their lifestyle as a response to therapy during the 5-year duration of the study. So what you have out there are a group of people that are ex-gays, ex-homosexuals. And if you can be an ex-gay or an ex-homosexual, obviously homosexuality is not an immutable characteristic. Now, how many ex-Hispanics do you know? How many ex-blacks do you know? How many ex-Asians do you know? I don't think we know of any, do we? And the reason we have no such ex-blacks is because being black is an immutable characteristic. Now, how many ex-homosexuals do you know? Well, there are those that are out there. Why do we have ex-homosexuals but we don't have ex-blacks? Because being black is an immutable characteristic. Being a homosexual is a learned behavior which is acquired over time. So we have ex-thieves, ex-drunkards, ex-gluttons, people that have their anger under control. They're ex-angry people. How can you become an ex-person in that sense? Because all of those things that are described are not immutable characteristics. They are behaviors which can be altered and changed over time with discipline. And they can be changed, of course, obviously under the power of the Holy Spirit. Let me remind you, if I could, what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. I had a chance to cover this on the last tape. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 through 11, as we covered this on the last DVD, I should say, not DVD, CD, there we go, getting my technology straight here, the last CD. You remember we went over this verse, or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor the effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. Such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of our God. 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 through 11. And so the last time we referenced that verse, we noted that homosexuality is just like all of these other sinful behaviors on this list, whether it be a drunkard or an idolater or a swindler. And homosexuals can change their spots or their stripes, just like a drunkard can, or a reviler can, or a covetous person can. So apparently homosexuals can change their stripes just as drunkards, adulterers, and thieves can. While there is no such thing as an ex-black, there are multiple cases of ex-gays. Why? The former is an innate and immutable characteristic, while the latter is a moral or sinful lifestyle. This point is also made in the book of Romans, you'll recall. You might remember Romans chapter 1, and you might remember verse 18. You might even flip in your Bible over there, Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. And you might remember what that particular verse says. Paul writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them." So it's talking about people there who reject God. And they reject God because they will not accept the revelation of God as disclosed in creation. You know, you look at creation and you look at the fact that no two snowflakes are the same. No two fingerprints are the same. You know, you look at the fact that this world that we are in, as it the earth rotates there around the sun, we're not so close to the sun that we burn up. We're not so far away from the sun that we freeze to death. But we rotate around the sun at exactly the right distance to sustain life. And we look at all of these wonders in our creation and we say there's obviously a God and there's obviously a creator, which should cause us to search for God so that we might come to know his son personally. But you see, the person that's a God hater or rejecter suppresses this obvious truth. And when they abandon God, God abandons them. And down in verses 26 and verse 27 of Romans 1, it says, "For this reason," now for what reason? They suppress the obvious revelation of God as disclosed in creation. "For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire for one another. Men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error or their perversion. So biblically, where does homosexuality come from? It comes from according to Romans 1, a rejection of divine truth, a rejection of God and his revelation and creation. And as people abandon God, God abandons them over to strange and perverse forms of sexuality. So you look at Romans 1 and you look at 1 Corinthians 6 verses 9 through 11, you learn very clearly that homosexuality is the result of sinful choices. It is not some sort of immutable, unchangeable quality or characteristic in people. So does the gay movement fit the first criteria? Piece of criteria here, first of the four criteria of being numerous. No, they don't represent 10% of the population. Well, what about the second prong here? Is being gay some kind of immutable characteristic? And the answer to that, I believe, is no as well. But what about this third characteristic? Is the homosexual, and is homosexual behavior, is it what we would call innocuous? In other words, is it something that doesn't hurt anybody? It doesn't hurt the people involved. It doesn't hurt anybody else. Obviously, being Asian doesn't hurt anybody, and it doesn't hurt the person that's Asian. The same with being Hispanic, the same with being black, the same with being a woman. The same with being a man. These are all immutable characteristics that are innocuous. I mean, you don't hurt somebody or yourself just because you're white or black or Hispanic or Asian or male or female. So to qualify for civil rights protection in this country, you need to be able to demonstrate this innocuousness. You have an immutable characteristic that is innocuous. Is the gay lifestyle innocuous, and is it harmless? And the answer is no. The gay lifestyle is a lifestyle which is extremely self-destructive. Let me read to you a little statistic here, if I could. Quite unlike the innocuous or harmless nature of one's skin color, the homosexual lifestyle is a self-destructive one. According to one study, now this particular study I'm getting from Stephen Wexner, who wrote an article in a medical periodical called Diseases of the Colon and the Rectum. And the title of this article is Sexually Transmitted Diseases of the Colon and the Rectum and the Anus, The Challenges of the 90s. So this article is a little dated, but it still kind of makes the point that I'm trying to make. And this is what Wexner says in this academic publication. He says up to 55% of homosexual men with anorectal complaints have gonorrhea. I mean, 55%. 80% of the patients with syphilis are homosexuals. Now, think about that for a minute. Homosexuals represent, what, 2% of the population? And yet, think of all of the people out there that have syphilis, and what you discover is 80% of that group are homosexuals, even though homosexuals represent a very small portion in comparison to the total population. He goes on and he says chlamydia is found in 15% of asymptomatic homosexual men, and up to one-third of homosexuals have active anorectal herpes simplex virus. In addition to a host of parasites, bacterial, viral, and protozoan are all rampant in the homosexual population. Now, what does Romans 1, verses 26 and 27 say? Remember how those verses conclude. It says they received in themselves the due penalty of their error, or they received in themselves the due penalty of their perversion. In fact, I've got the New American Standard Bible here. Let me just read those verses to us, just so we can get them exactly down here. Romans 1, describing homosexuality, verses 26 and 27. It says, "For this reason God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural, and in the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire one for another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error." You see, God has given us laws and rules and principles and morals to follow because He knows what's going to damage us chemically, medically, spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically. And if I just run in a lawless way, roughshod over God's standards, including His sexual standards, then I am outside the hedge of protection, and I'm going to suffer a lot of problems in my body as a result. It would be like getting in my car, and every time I see a stop sign or a red stoplight, I just decide to ignore it. Well, that stop sign and that stoplight is there for my protection. But if I decide to ignore it, think of all the things that can happen. Think of all of the opportunities I have to get into a collision or to hit somebody or to have someone hit me, and God forbid, you know, I could die simply by ignoring the rules that are set up for my protection. And that's essentially what homosexuality is. You've got a bunch of people that have just decided that the rules don't apply to them, and the Bible says they would receive in their bodies, it's very clear, the word body is used there, I believe. I may be in error about that. Looking a little bit more carefully at the text, it says receiving in their own persons. I'm sorry, I misstated that. But it does say in their own persons the due penalty of their error. So you run roughshod over God's principles and morals, and, you know, we then expect to receive problems in your physical body, your emotional makeup, your psyche, and, you know, those kinds of things. So what I'm trying to say is homosexuality an innocuous lifestyle? And the answer to that is no. So that criterion, or of those four criteria, that third prong there is not met. Now, what about this fourth prong here, fourth of the criteria, that you have to demonstrate a pattern of historical discrimination against you? In other words, we just don't give people civil rights status just because they want it. They have to fit the criteria. And one of those four criteria is you have to show that you have been targeted for discriminatory practices historically, totally on the basis of your immutable characteristic. As I said before, blacks have no problem demonstrating this when you look at the Jim Crow South and the residues of slavery and the, you know, the Ku Klux Klan that was active in this country in our past, and things like that. I mean, obviously, being black, you would qualify. But are gays discriminated against? Are they targeted? The answer to that, I believe, is a resounding no. And let me just give you some statistics on this, if I could, just so I can make my point. Here is an article from USA Today written by Margaret Usdansky, and it was published in USA Today, and the title of it is Gay Couples by the Numbers. And notice what this particular article says. Homosexual couples who live together may be wealthier than heterosexual live-in couples, An analysis of new census numbers suggests gay male couples appear to be particularly affluent, out-earning even married couples. Gay male couples had about a $57,000 household income on average. Married couples had a $47,000 household income on average. And then heterosexual unmarried couples had about a $38,000, $37,000 a year income on average. So what do these statistics show? They show that homosexuals are not discriminated against in our culture. In fact, they are among the most affluent members of our culture. Beyond this, think about this just for a minute. A homosexual couple cannot reproduce. So unless they're living in a state where gay adoption is legal, chances are a gay couple has no children. They have no dependents. So you don't have to pay for extra car insurance for children. You don't have to pay for diapers. You don't have to pay for tuition costs, private school costs. You don't have to be involved in homeschooling. And you have all of this extra time and all of this extra disposable income in your bank account. And this is why homosexual couples can give a huge amount of money to political causes. That's why the gay lobby has become such a powerful political force. Because unlike your typical heterosexual couple, they've got all this disposable income. They have no dependents. And all of those costs associated with having kids, they don't have to bear. So they can dump those that disposable income into the pockets of politicians, and that's why when the gay lobby speaks, politicians listen, because that constitutes a very large percentage of that particular politician's donor base. And so it's quite clear that this fourth criteria here, you've got to be able to historically demonstrate that you've been discriminated against. It's obvious that this does not apply to homosexuals. Now, one of the things that's interesting to remember is Sodom and Gomorrah, which was a city characterized by homosexuality. The book of Ezekiel, chapter 16 and verse 49, portrays those that were living in Sodom and Gomorrah as being quite affluent, and they could care less about the poor. So they were not using their wealth to help the poor. So it seems like homosexuality and wealth in the Bible go together. And that's how it seems also here in America. Now, one of the things that's argued all the time is, well, what are you talking about? Don't you realize that homosexuals are targeted for violent crimes? Don't you understand that homosexuals are routinely attacked, routinely accosted, routinely physically victimized, and so forth? What's interesting is that statistic is completely untrue. Let me read to you a few statistics, if I could. This is from a book called John Ammon, and it's called 10 Truths About Hate Crime Laws. And this is what he says. He says, set against so-called epidemic of hate crimes in America are the 1,400,000 total crimes committed against persons or properties in the year 2006. This is compared to about 9,000 bias motivation crimes in that year. Now, bias motivation crime is a crime where someone is attacked specifically because of their homosexuality. The writer goes on and he says, hate crimes account for 0.08% of the total crime problem facing America. So, you know, we talk a lot about these hate crimes. In other words, people are targeted because of their race or their homosexuality or their gender or something of that, or their religion. And, you know, we're made to believe that there's this rash of hate crimes in America. But the fact of the matter is hate crimes account for only 0.08% of the total crime problem facing America. The writer goes on and he says, but that's not all. Just 1,400 of the 9,000 or so hate crimes reported to the FBI in 2006 were identified as prejudice against the victim's sexual orientation. Crimes against homosexuals as an identified class are just 0.012% of all crimes committed in America. Now, we're made to believe that there's this epidemic of violence against homosexuals, and that's an emotional argument. But what did the facts actually say? Crimes committed against homosexuals because they're homosexuals represent 0.012% of all crime committed in America. The media gives us a different impression, but the fact of the matter is there is no rampant violence against homosexuals in America, specifically because they are homosexuals. Now, we continue on with this, and we learn even more. Now, there was an individual that was brutally murdered October 6th, 1998. His name was Matthew Shepard. And if you were to watch the news during that time period, you would think that this man was beaten up completely because he was gay. Contrary to not just beat up, but killed because he was gay. Contrary to the widespread opinion perpetuated by the liberal media, even the infamous victimization and brutal murder of Matthew Shepard on October 6, 1998, had nothing to do with anti-gay bigotry due to Shepard's homosexual orientation. Separating emotional hype from the actual facts of the case has been documented by Stephen Jimenez in a book that he wrote called The Book of Matt, a book in honor of this man, individual Matthew Shepard, who supposedly was the victim of a hate crime. All of America was made to believe that this man was killed and brutally murdered expressly because of his homosexuality. Well, now it comes out after all the dust has settled and years have passed that this man was not killed because of his homosexuality. The media gave the American public the exact opposite impression. Let me read from the introduction of this book called The Book of Matt by Stephen Jimenez. Stephen Jimenez went to Laramie to research the story of Matthew Shepard's murder in 2000 after two men convicted of killing him had gone to prison and after the national media had moved on. His aim was to write a screenplay on what he and the rest of the nation believed to be an open and shut case of bigoted violence against a gay man. He felt an added moral imperative to tell Matthew's story. But what Jimenez eventually found in Wyoming was a tangled web of secrets. His exhaustive investigation also plunged him deep into the deadly underworld of drug trafficking. Over the course of a 13-year investigation, Jimenez traveled 20 states in Washington, D.C., and interviewed more than 100 named sources. The Book of Matt is sure to stir passions and inspire dialogue as it reframes this misconstrued crime and its cast of characters, proving irrefutably that Matthew Shepard was not killed for being gay, but for reasons far more complicated and daunting. So even the infamous Matthew Shepard case that was so aggressively promoted by the media, even that particular case was not a hate crime either. Now, you say, well, wait a minute, aren't there an epidemic of gay teenage suicides? I mean, we're given this impression today that homosexuals need all of this legal protection because they're victims of bullying in the public schools. And there's this rash of gay suicides as a result. And once again, we need to separate hype from fiction. I want to read to you just a couple of lines, if I could, from Marilyn Elias, who wrote an article entitled Gay Teens Less Suicidal Than Thought, Report Says. And this was published in USA Today in November of 2011. And this is what this particular article says. Gay and lesbian teenagers are only slightly more likely than heterosexual kids to attempt suicide. Contrary to past studies that suggest gay youths have about triple the rate of trying suicide, says Cornell University psychologist, a Cornell University psychologist. Studies finding that about 30% of gay adolescents have attempted suicide. Studies show that they have exaggerated the rates because they surveyed the most disturbed youngsters and didn't separate thoughts from action, says Richen Savin-Williams. Nearly all research on the topic has drawn teens from support groups or shelters where the most troubled gather. And he has taken at face value the claim of a suicide attempt, he says. Savin-Williams' own two studies focus on 349 students ages 17 to 25. When they said they tried to kill themselves, he asked what method they used. He also separated out the minority that attended support groups. Over half of the reported suicide attempts turned out to be people that were just thinking about it rather than actually doing anything about it. The other study of 266 college men and women found that gay youths were not significantly more likely than straight classmates to have tried to take their own lives. Again, the homosexual students were more likely to report attempts that further questioning revealed as thoughts. Poorly designed studies that exaggerate their suicide risk pathologize gay youth, and that's not fair to them, says the person that did these reports. So, you know, you can read this article for yourself, but you can see that a lot of these studies that are being brought out that, you know, gays are far more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual counterparts, those statistics have been doctored as well, and those statistics aren't separating thoughts of suicide from actual physical suicide attempts. And those studies are also lopsided in terms of their sample set. They're interviewing people that are in shelters that are already extremely troubled individuals to begin with. So just like this idea that 10% of the population is gay, and how that Kinsey report has been discredited, many of these studies are discredited when you actually get into the particulars of it and become interested in separating fact from emotional hype. What am I trying to say? The bottom line is that homosexuals cannot demonstrate that they have been historically discriminated against in American society. The economic data does not support it. They cannot demonstrate that they are victimized by hate crimes that are represent a number that's disproportionate, out of control. They can't even demonstrate that gay teens commit suicide more than heterosexuals. So they have not been targeted for discrimination in American society, contrary to African Americans that were enslaved and made to sit at segregated lunch counters. So do homosexuals, and should they qualify for elevated civil rights protection under the law? The answer is no. They don't fit the four criteria. They're not numerous. They don't have an immutable characteristic. The characteristic that supposedly they're targeted based upon is not harmless or innocuous, and there is no historical pattern of discrimination economically or in any other category against homosexuals in American society. So this huge movement and attempt for gays to say we deserve the same elevated civil rights treatment that's given to blacks or Asians or Hispanics, that argument should not work. Gays do not deserve elevated civil rights protection under the law. And yet they keep demanding it. Why do they keep demanding it even though they don't fit the criteria given to those that receive such elevated treatment? The answer goes right back to this article from 1987 entitled The Overhauling of Straight America by Marshall Kirk and Erastus Phil, published in a homosexual magazine in 1987. In any campaign to win over the public, gays must cast themselves as victims in need of protection so that straights will be inclined by reflex to assume the role of protector. So the name of the game here is, if we're going to overhaul straight society, we need to portray ourselves as victims. And that's the propaganda campaign that's going on. And that's why many people think gays deserve civil rights protection under the law. But what I've tried to demonstrate is homosexuals deserve no such protection any more than people that are 6 foot six, like myself, deserve such protection. So what's the name of the game here? What's the gay agenda politically and legally all about? We want to portray ourselves as victims so we can get laws passed in our favor. Once we get elevated civil rights protection, then we can use that law as a legal weapon to punish or attack any group that does not embrace the gay lifestyle. And that's how we're going to overhaul straight America. We're going to portray ourselves as victims. They admitted this strategy back in 1987. Then they get the laws passed in their favor, granting them civil rights protection. And now they can go forth with a legal weapon and attack anybody that they think is not accommodating of their lifestyle. We can go after the Boy Scouts. We can go after the Girl Scouts. We can go after the military. We can go after the American Psychological Association. We can go after the American Psychiatric Association. We can go after Christian-owned and operated businesses. We eventually, sadly, is going to get to the point, I believe, where they're going to begin to go after pastors and go after churches. Now, why are they doing this? This mentality exhibits something that I like to call Sodom's second coming. Now, think of the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. If you go back to Genesis 19 for just a moment, take a look at verse 9. Let's remember what was going on in that particular city. You remember all of the individuals in the city, all of the men, both young and old, surrounded the home of Lot. They demanded that Lot release the two visitors, male visitors, that had come to his house that night. And you remember what Lot said? Lot said, "We'll take my virgin daughters instead." And you remember the reaction of that crowd? Genesis 19:9. "But they," that is the crowd outside of Lot's house, "said, 'Stand aside.' Furthermore," they said, "'this one came in as an alien,'" referring to Lot, "'he came in as an alien, and he is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them.' So they pressed hard against Lot, and came near to break down the door. And you'll find this in Genesis 19:9. Why was this crowd so angry when Lot said, take my two virgin daughters instead of these two men who have come to seek protective custody in my home for the evening? This crowd became offended at the mere suggestion that their sexual proclivity was abnormal. And that's what I think is really going on here. Apparently, they interpreted Lot's offer of his daughters as criticism or judgment upon their lifestyle. This explains why they complained that Lot was acting like a judge. So any suggestion that we are abnormal, any suggestion that our sexual proclivity is wrong, we're going to react against that in a very hostile way. Now, what did Jesus say about Sodom and Gomorrah? Jesus said this in Luke 17, verses 28 through 30. Christ himself predicted the identical moral climate would again exist upon the earth just prior to his return. In Luke 17, verses 28 through 30, this is what we read. Jesus prophesied it was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Now here's the words of Christ. It will be just the same on the day the Son of Man is revealed. So what Jesus is revealing here is what I like to call Sodom's second coming. The same militant homosexual mindset that existed in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, that acted as if Lot was treating them as their judge and reacted violently against Lot and his mere suggestion that they ought to take his two virgin daughters instead, you know, the fact that they took that as some sort of criticism of their lifestyle and reacted violently against it, that's the same moral climate which will exist before the Son of Man returns. There is a fascinating scripture in the book of Revelation, chapter 11, and verse 8. It says this. It talks about the city where their Lord was crucified. Revelation 11, verse 8 predicts the same moral climate descending upon God's chosen city in the last days when it describes Jerusalem, the city where their Lord was crucified, as mystically called Sodom and Egypt. Egypt would represent bondage, and of course Sodom would represent the depravity that we see back in Genesis 19. And that same moral depravity will exist in the last days, according to Christ's prophecy in Luke 17, verses 28 through 30, and it will even encompass God's very own city just before he comes back, the city of Jerusalem, and we see that in Revelation 11 and verse 8. And so essentially what is happening today as we get closer and closer to the return of the Lord is that the Sodom's second coming is taking place and is transpiring before our very eyes. Today, any mere suggestion that homosexuality is abnormal is taken as great offense, and there is a great verbal and sometimes physical reaction against it. The identical pressure that the gay lobby has consistently placed on the United States military, the Boy Scouts of America, the American Psychological Association, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty, and Dan Cathy of Chick-fil-A, was exhibited a couple of weeks ago against Governor Mike Pence and the state of Indiana. It's very, very interesting. how today mere criticism of the homosexual lifestyle, any insinuation that the homosexual lifestyle is abnormal, gets a vituperative and hysterical reaction. And so this is the time period that we're living in. And this is what I like to call Sodom's second coming. Let me read to you a couple of sentences, if I could, from a book entitled When the Wicked Sees a City. And it's written by Chuck and Donna McElhaney. It was published, I believe, around 1993. And at that time, they were pastoring the First Orthodox Presbyterian Church in San Francisco. And the back of this book, entitled When the Wicked Sees a City, reads, "The house is on fire. A highly publicized lawsuit, a house firebombed in the night, the shatter of windows smashed by politically and wickedly motivated vandals into the night, all because Chuck McElhaney voiced condemnation of a behavior and a lifestyle and protested the destruction of a society that results from its practice. That behavior is homosexuality, and that lifestyle is the gay culture. He was subsequently hounded and terrorized in his own town." This book explores the gay power and what it will mean if Christians do not organize and prepare for battle. A well-known counselor, Dr. J. Adams, wrote the foreword to the book, and notice what he says. "If you want to know all about the homosexual movement, even more than you may wish to know, and know how you as a Christian should relate to it, then this book is for you. In the chapters that follow, you will read the struggles of the pastor of a small church and his family living in the midst of San Francisco, a great city captured and controlled by gay activists. You will read about what happened when they make an outspoken stand against great odds and against the forces of evil. You might think that after attempts to burn down their church, threats on their lives of their children, lawsuits, and innumerable other attacks, Pastor McElhaney and his family would exhibit bitterness and hatred. Nothing like that is found in this book. While at every point abhorring compromise with sin, the book exhibits throughout a remarkable compassion for those enslaved by the sexual movement, which falsely promised them freedom. It's one of a kind, and it should be read by every thinking Christian." So what they're warning against in this book is Sodom's second coming, how it took control of the city of San Francisco, and how that same mindset is on its way all over America. So what's the name of the game? Portray yourself as a victim, get the law changed, get elevated civil rights protection, and then use that as a weapon to attack and to punish and to silence everyone that may have a different perspective on homosexuality than the gay lobby. And that is essentially what I would call the legal and political agenda behind the gay rights movement today. And what can we expect to happen as Sodom's second coming takes a foothold? What we can expect is a loss of freedom. If I can read to you very quickly a recent court case, and it involves, well, actually these types of court cases are breaking out all over the country. It reads as follows. Jack Phillips is a baker who declined to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple because his Christian belief is that marriage exists only between a man and a woman. Now a Colorado judge has ordered him to bake cakes for same-sex marriages, and if Phillips refuses, he could go to jail. That's the type of thing that we see happening all around us as we move into this environment entitled Sodom's Second Coming. So it's quite tragic what is taking place. Here is a citation from another book entitled Our Gay Rights Right, and this was published around 1990. It says, more recently in Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Hacklander and Maureen Rowe were renting an apartment and looking for a roommate to share the expense. When Carrie Sprague expressed an interest in living with them and disclosed she was a lesbian, they told her politely that they would prefer someone else. Sprague took the matter immediately to the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission, the MEOC, an agency charged with enforcement of the Madison gay rights law. The MEOC summoned Hacklander and Rowe to a meeting that proved to be a 4.5-hour self-criticism session. Reduced to tears at the meeting, Hacklander said she felt like she was in China, not the United States. The results of the meeting was an agreement exacted by the MEOC. The two women would pay Sprague $1,500, would attend a sensitivity training class taught by homosexuals, would have their housing situation monitored by the MEOC for 2 years, and would apologize to Sprague in a formal letter. When Rowe, a recent graduate, claimed that the settlement would bankrupt her, she was told her bankruptcy was of no consequence to the MEOC. The city council later amended the law so it would not apply to roommate situations, but the MEOC continued to lumber along with its case against the two women anyway, knowing that even if Hacklander and Rowe were ultimately to win, they would still have lost in attorney's fees, stress, and time. And this is the United States of America, where these things are happening right under our noses. And it's a tragic thing. And, of course, this brings us up to speed with what happened recently with Governor Pence in Indiana. You may have followed what happened recently, where there was a hysterical reaction against him because he signed into law something called RFRA. RFRA simply stands for the Restoration of, find the exact wording of that so I don't butcher it. RFRA stands for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And once he signed that, there was this huge reaction against him. A number of companies and organizations and athletes and other high-profile voices expressed strong opinions to Indiana Governor Mike Pence signing the controversial religious freedom bill into law last week. Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, is even among the vociferous objectors. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe used the opportunity to invite Indiana-located businesses to uproot and move to Virginia. There have been cancellations of numerous conventions and concerts originally scheduled in Indiana, even cancellation of the Final Four, which was scheduled to be played in Indiana this week, has been floated. Many high-profile Americans, regardless of their connection or lack thereof to the issue, have been asked their position on the new Indiana RFRA law. Mike Krzyzewski, the head coach of the Final Four qualifier Duke University, has been queried. Sadly, those supportive of the new law in some cases have had their businesses destroyed and their physical lives threatened. That these attacks have all been waged on what most Christians regard as Holy Week demonstrates what little respect the homosexual activists have towards Christianity in general. In fact, the criticism has been so severe that Governor Mike Pence seems to be backing off his original position. Well, sadly, on this particular CD, I am out of time. I wanted to wrap up my thoughts, and so what I'm going to do is continue this on the next CD, and I want to continue to talk about the political and the legal agenda behind the civil rights movement for gays, how the desire is to portray yourself as a victim. And once you portray yourself as a victim, you can use civil rights law as a weapon to silence all opposition. And so we will continue this discussion and its horrific aftermaths on our next CD together.